You're listening to The Dice Men Cometh, proudly sponsored by Area 52, Tasmania's largest independent pop culture retailer. Find them at 104 Elizabeth Street, Hobart, or online at area52.com.au.
The Dice Men Cometh!
Hello everyone, it's me, Mark. I'm here to let you all know that we're off to BorderCon this week, so no regular episode. But we do have a very special treat for you. I interviewed Jamie Stegmaier from Stonemaier Games about everything that he's been up to. I'm going to play that for you now, and I hope you enjoy it in place of our regular episode. And we'll see you when we come back from BorderCon with so much to talk about. Anyway, here's Jamie and I having a lovely chat. So this morning I'm very excited to be joined by someone who needs no introduction in our hobby, but I tell you what, I think he deserves one. So here goes. He's the Viceroy of Viticulture. He's the Earl of Euphoria, the Champion of Charterstone, the Scion of Scythe, and the Strongmeister of Stonemaier Games. It's Jamie Stegmaier. Hello, Jamie. How are you going?
Hey, Mark. Thank you so much for having me. That's a very nice introduction.
No, look, it's great. You've done so much great work in our hobby. And look, I want to get to a whole bunch of it. But firstly, look, I got to say, I don't know that Alan Stone is carrying his weight. Are you going to change the name of the company someday?
Well, yeah, we chose the name before we really knew how responsibilities would shake out. But I still like the name. It's a good, strong name, Stonemaier.
It certainly has that European feel, that's for sure. And I guess for hitting that tone in the market when it first started, it really carried the thought of, you know, Euro games. And I guess our hobby has changed quite a bit over the years. But yeah, I look at it's a nice one. Do you still work together?
We do. Yeah, Alan. I run the day-to-day operations of the company. But Alan, he is the one that receives all game submissions. And so he receives dozens of submissions every week, and he kind of filters them out and goes through several filters. And then sometimes if we request one, he will learn it and we will play it together. He does that, and he coordinates our replacement parts team, which may not seem like much, but we actually replace thousands of little bits and pieces and cards and things that are lost and broken every year. So he doesn't ship all of that himself, but he coordinates the team that does.
As someone who's certainly ordered a game in the past, not from you guys, but found a piece missing and then tracked it down, I know how incredibly important that is. And as gamers, very often we're skirting on the edge of OCD. So to make the game perfect, that is a very important role, that's for sure. Now, Jamie, before we get into the meat of what I want to ask you about, what hot new game have you just discovered? And tell me what you love about it.
I would say the newest, I don't know if it's quite hot yet because it's pretty new over here in the US, but I think it will be, is the Journeyman expansion to Isle of Skye. Ooh. Have you played Isle of Skye?
Yeah, I have, but not the expansion, I must admit.
Yeah, the expansion, I think it maybe came out in Europe a few months ago, maybe even as far back as Essen, but it just got to here in the US, and I've played it twice. Isle of Skye is one of my favorite games, and it changes the game quite a bit. It makes it a lot meatier. It fills a completely different gap than Isle of Skye did. But I've really enjoyed it, my plays of it so far, and I look forward to playing it again.
Awesome.
What about you, Webb? Have you played anything brand new to you?
What have we just got to the table? I've just got Azul to the table, believe it or not. I was a little bit slow on that that cart. Uh-huh. I actually bought it for my partner, who's just getting into games. And she has loved it. She's taught it to her friends. I've taught it to some of my friends. And it's certainly my pick for the Spiel des Jahres, I think. When I played it, it hadn't yet been nominated. And I just straight away I thought, oh, wow, this is just the perfect Spiel game. Just because it's so easy to pick up. But there is a depth of strategy there that you can get to once you start to know the game. Have you played that one?
I have, yeah. That was one where the first time I played it, I didn't quite get it. I was like, yeah, well, that's okay. And then I returned to it and really fell in love with it. It's a wonderful abstract game.
Yeah, yeah, and it looks beautiful, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it does.
Okay, now, I want to take you back, wind the wheels of time back. So what are the two or three games that you really remember from your childhood And I'm curious to see whether any of these, there's been any influence in any of your games.
Sure, yeah. So three that come to mind right off the top of my head, and I'm kind of lucky, I grew up in a family where we play a lot of games, so I could name quite a few. But a few that really jump out are, so I'll start with the one that's probably the most common, Risk. I did play a lot of Risk as a kid with my friends and a little bit with my family. Really, really loved that. The second one is a game called Scotland Yard. Have you ever heard of Scotland Yard?
Yep, absolutely.
That's one that's been delightful for me to rediscover also as an adult. I usually don't like hidden movement games, but for some reason the simplicity of that game and the tension and that it's not too long, I loved it as a kid and I love it as an adult. And then the last one is a really obscure game that had a really, really beautiful board called Key to the Kingdom. Have you heard of that one?
No, I haven't.
I suspect that it's pretty rarely known. It's just a random game. It had a big, beautiful box, lots of art, had this fantasy theme to it. Not a ton of gameplay that I recall, but it did have an interesting thing where you move around the board and you're trying to discover where a certain mystery is, and you need to go to certain spots to find out where it was randomly placed at the beginning of the game. And I loved it as a kid, just mostly because of the theme and the art. So those are my three.
Okay. And do you think that any of those has crept into any of your games?
Subconsciously, maybe Key to the Kingdom, because of the theme, the art, those are things that I try to focus on in my designs. For Scotland Yard, I haven't done a hidden movement game, but as I've rediscovered it, I've come to really appreciate how a very simple rule set can lead to a lot of interesting decisions, and it makes it the game easier to get to the table more often because it's easier to teach new people. Kind of like Azul, as you mentioned. So I've come to appreciate that more. Again, maybe a subconscious impact on me. And then Risk, I would actually say the greater influence of Risk was Risk Legacy, which I played about 4 years ago.
Yes.
That's how I fell in love with the Legacy format and ended up eventually designing a Legacy game myself called Charterstone.
Yes. Now, I want to get to Charterstone in a while. I'm sort of gonna stay in the past for a little while. So you said your whole family played games?
Yeah, yeah. I would say I probably played more with friends, but we had a game closet full of classic games as a family. Yeah.
Okay, because I think I know myself. My mother loved Scrabble. And that really got me into word games and broadened my vocabulary. You wouldn't think so sometime to hear me speak, but you know, it's amazing how formative those early games can be.
Yeah.
So when did you first think about designing a game? Because I know talking to Phil Walker Harding and his brother David, they tell a story of, you know, being kids, I think younger than 10, and first designing a game for themselves to play. When did you first think about designing a game?
Actually, right around that same time. I would say when I was maybe 7 or 8. I don't remember the exact age, but I think one of the first games I played was Monopoly, and I designed this is kind of a pattern of the games I designed as a youth. They were often like spin-offs of existing games. So the game that I designed was called Medieval Quest, and it was a medieval version of Monopoly, essentially. Not exact mechanisms, but definitely, you know, roll and move around a board with Knights of the Round Table theme on it.
Okay. And then did you stay with games and game design a long time, or did you sort of let that go away and start growing up and then come back to it later?
And pretty consistently my whole life, every couple of years I would design a game. Especially when I was younger, maybe even every year, because I had more time on my hands. So I would say the biggest gap was probably in college when I think I only designed one game.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of a gap after college where I hadn't been I think I was ready for Euro games, but I didn't know they existed yet. So I didn't play or design mini games for a couple of years. And then I was brought back into the hobby with Settlers of Catan and Agricola.
Okay. And I think that's probably the journey that I was going to say almost all of us started. I'm a little bit older. And I sort of came back to those games a bit later in life when I had my children. That's a journey you've yet to discover, I understand.
That's correct. Yeah, I'm 37. I don't know if I have two cats, but no kids.
Fair enough. Now, so then it seems you got into blogging at a time when I guess the world was discovering blogging. You seem to get into it in a big way, and you've written a book about blogging. So what got you into blogging?
You know, I had a few friends who were using it. I think this was pre-Facebook. They were kind of using it as a way to post about their life and stay connected to other friends. Mm-hmm. This was post-college. And they were using a platform called LiveJournal, which I think still exists, but it hasn't been updated, I think, in years. And so I started out on that as a whim, just to give it a try, because I fancied myself a writer, and I wanted to get into the habit of daily writing. And I found I really loved it. And so for the last, I think, 11 years, I've blogged on my personal blog 5 days a week, pretty much every night, 5 days a week for the last 11 years.
Yeah, I've noticed you're very regular. And it's not just about games. You're blogging, as you said, about all aspects of your life. And so you even wrote a book about blogging?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, maybe around 6 or 7 years ago, I wrote just a PDF digital download book based on what I had learned from blogging and over the years, and just thought I'd put it out there. I think it's just in the sidebar of my personal blog for people to check out if they're interested in blogging.
Yeah, I saw it there the other day, and I was like, this is part of you that I wasn't aware of. So you, look, I have to say, you're amazing at putting out there into the world what you're doing and sharing it. And I guess that brings me to the next big thing for me, which was viticulture and Kickstarter. So you are known by many as a guru on Kickstarter. So how did you first decide that Kickstarter was going to be the way to bring viticulture to the world? And can you just talk us through that thought process of that very first Kickstarter campaign?
Yeah. It actually started with Kickstarter. I learned about Kickstarter when it launched. I think I read an article about it, and I was absolutely fascinated with it from the beginning. I think partially I had an entrepreneurial spirit, and just there were certain aspects of it that fascinated me, like the idea that you could have direct relationships with all of your customers through this platform. I loved that idea. And so I followed Kickstarter for a while. I backed projects. I started to notice game projects on there. And once I started to see that, I was kind of inspired by them. These are projects like by Tasty Minstrel Games, Crash Games, and a few others. And I thought, you know, I'll take this lifelong hobby of mine of designing games from time to time, and I'll see if I can apply it to this fascination of Kickstarter. And that's how Viticulture started out.
And so Viticulture, obviously very, very successful, a multitude of expansions, including Tuscany. But not just the fact that your game was so successful, but I think that the campaign was managed so well. Your communication was fantastic. You've really, it was used by a model by so many people on Kickstarter. But then you also, obviously, you did a lot of blogging about Kickstarter. And I guess you could say that you really took the world on the Kickstarter journey with you, and you shared so many things about it. What had you decide to tell the whole world to take them along on that journey with you?
Well, it started after the Kickstarter campaign ended in 2012, fall of 2012 for Viticulture. I wanted to have a media presence on the Stillmire Games website. But at the time, I was just kind of releasing more information about the game. And it got to the point where I was like, well, I'm not really adding anything useful to anyone. I don't know why anyone would read this. And I thought, you know, I've had this experience now. I made a lot of mistakes on this campaign. I think I did a few things right. Maybe I can share those things with other people so that they have a resource that I didn't have when I launched my campaign, so that they could not make the mistakes that I did. And that's when I started writing this Kickstarter lesson series on my blog, I guess partially to process my own thoughts and put down my thoughts in words, but also to help other people and start that conversation with other people and see what they thought about Kickstarter. So I've been doing that about two entries a week for the last what, 6 years, 5 or 6 years?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, back then, as you said, Kickstarter was very new. I mean, now we, on our show, we do a weekly show, and pretty much at least once a month, we have a session where we talk about Kickstarter, because there's so much. We're right, when you started, it was so, so new. People didn't really know what they were doing. There weren't these miniature fests that bring in millions and millions of dollars.
Right.
So you really champion that. And I know one of the first companies we spoke to here in Australia, Rule and Make Games,
they
talked about how you inspired them and how following your blog and following your lessons really helped them to drive a really strong campaign. So you've absolutely influenced a lot of people, that's for sure, on Kickstarter. Now, interestingly, I've heard you say that you're planning not to use Kickstarter for your next game. Is that right?
Yeah, we actually, I haven't used it since the end of 2015 when I ran the Scythe Kickstarter campaign. That was the last one. And it wasn't immediately after that I decided not to use it again, but it was rather after the fulfillment of Scythe that I took a good hard look at how that process went, how I was doing as a person, how I wanted to spend my time running Stonemaier Games, and some other discussions, some other factors that I had with some of the other people who I work with or talk with or get advice from. And we decided at that time not to run Kickstarters for future games and to actually move more towards a traditional model, but take all those things that I learned from Kickstarter about community and communication and fairness and bring those to our current model. So yeah, I haven't used it in a couple of years, and I don't, as much as I love it, and I still write about it, you know, all the time, I'm fascinated by it, I don't intend to use Kickstarter itself anymore.
Okay, and I know we often comment about, let's say, companies like Queen Games, and sort of scratch our heads as why would a big company like Queen Games, with plenty of money, plenty of skin in the game, need to use Kickstarter? And I guess a lot of people use it like a pre-order system now. But I think a lot of the time that takes the light away from other games that perhaps need some attention to actually get and be on Kickstarter and get funded. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about other companies' use of Kickstarter now?
Well, whether it's a person running a Kickstarter campaign or a bigger company, for me, in my opinion, is that it comes down to their intentions and how they do it. I applaud any company that uses a Kickstarter or pre-order campaigns to help them gauge demand or to build community, to build buzz, to make the product better through stretch goals. I don't want to presume that another company has a lot of money, because you never really know how their cash flow is unless they've disclosed that. So it might be true that they really need the money at that particular time to afford a decent print run of the game. So with all those intentions wrapped together, I applaud anyone who uses Kickstarter, especially if they treat their backers well. And so I actually think it's pretty rare that a company doesn't do those things. And if they don't do those things, oftentimes their backers just stop supporting them after a while, because I think backers are drawn to those things.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's I am always excited to see when, I guess excited to see a project fall over is not right, but I'm excited to see the intelligence of backers and, you know, when they almost get a sniff that something's not quite right, how, you know, it's people just aren't piling onto a game now and forget about it. People will actually pull out and you'll see backer numbers go down. So I think the Kickstarter audience is certainly getting smarter, that's for sure.
And I think that's one of the wonderful things about Kickstarter, that it is backer driven. And so it's a very democratic system in that way.
Yeah. Now I want to get on to, you mentioned Legacy before. Now, obviously, Charterstone, you've made use of the Legacy concept there. And now you've just got Scythe Rise of Fenris, your latest expansion coming out. And it's got, as I understand, an episodic story where you're unlocking things. So clearly you're a fan of the Legacy concept, and you mentioned Risk. How do you want to talk to our listeners about Legacy, your thoughts about it, and where you see it going?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I mentioned that I discovered Legacy through Risk Legacy, and I've also enjoyed playing Seafall and the two Pandemic Legacies. Those are the main Legacy games out there. So Legacy, to me, people have defined it in different ways, but to me it is a game that features permanence. Anything permanent that cannot be undone. And while I don't want every game to have that, the psychological impact of putting a sticker down permanently or naming something permanently has it scratches an itch that I didn't even know I had until I played Risk Legacy. And so I love that aspect. And Charterstone is wrapped around that aspect of making permanent decisions. The other thing that is often associated with Legacy but isn't necessarily part of it is unlocking and discovery, that element of discovery, which is something else that is featured in many of these Legacy games. You're unlocking tuck boxes and opening up new cards and stuff like that, new envelopes. And that's something I went all out for in Charterstone. And that aspect is in The Rise of Fenris. That's the new expansion to Scythe, which has no permanence in it. It isn't a Legacy expansion, but it does feature those elements of unlocking and discovering things as you play through the campaign.
And so I've only just started to read about Rise of Fenris. With that, could you basically pack everything back up and start from scratch again if you're playing through it again with a different group?
Absolutely. Yeah. You can play through the campaign as much as you want. You can completely reset it and replay it. And you also, if you don't have a group that you can get together with on a consistent basis, it's also a modular expansion. So you can just open it up and open everything up and start playing with different combinations of the modules that are inside the box.
Okay. And then the other really interesting thing I love that you did with Charterstone is the two-sided board. So basically you've get to run the game twice if you buy a refill pack. Is that right?
Yeah, that's actually one of the products of me discussing Charterstone with people before we started printing it. Originally, it was just going to be a one-sided board, and some people suggested that we make it double-sided so that they could reset the game and buy a recharge pack that just has all the things that were permanently changed the first time around without having to repay for all the wooden pieces and the metal coins and all that stuff that come in the box. So, yeah, that was a customer idea that came up that we ended up pursuing.
Oh, wow, that's awesome. And I know, look, I haven't got to Charterstone yet. I've got in mind, I want to play that with my partner, the one I mentioned I bought Azul for, and she's just getting into gaming. And I think that is going to be absolutely perfect for her. My partners and I in the Dice Men Cometh, we suffered a bit of Pandemic Legacy fatigue where I think it's because of, you know, having to play new games all the time to generate content for the show. We found we weren't coming back to it quickly enough. And so, believe it or not, we are in November of Pandemic Legacy Season 1, having started that game over 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And now it's sort of like it's been going on for so long. It's almost like the joy's gone out of it for us, which is a bit sad.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I had a chat with Matt Leacock a little while ago. I think it's a brilliant game, brilliant design. But I challenged him a little bit as a designer on the system where you could end up playing 24 games of it if you lose every game. And it can be as short as 12, but I think hardly anyone actually just plays 12 games. Usually it's probably an average of 16 to 18, which is a lot of games to play of one game.
Yes.
So I designed Charterstone. Originally it was going to be 20 games, and I cut it down to 12. I almost wish I had cut it down to 10. But in the end, Charterstone was designed so you can play two games back-to-back in a session in about, depending on your group, in about 2.5 or 3 hours total. So that way you can get through it a little bit quicker, because we have so many cool games to play these days. So,
It's such a great problem to have, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I'm really excited to see what you're planning next, potentially with Legacy. Are you looking at doing expansions for Charterstone to do more with it, or are you looking maybe to take Legacy to a new game?
You know, I'm always looking for new challenges in design. I want to push different buttons. I want to try different things. So currently, I don't have any plans to do expansions for Charterstone. Because it is designed actually both as a Legacy game, but also when you finish the 12-game arc, you can continue to play it. You have a village that you can play. There's some replayable things that come in at the very end that ensure that you get a different experience every time. So I'm not exploring anything with that for now. The campaign format or persistent storytelling and narrative is something I would definitely like to just explore a little bit more. And I am working on a cooperative game that has a little bit of that, but that can also be played very much so as just a standalone game.
It's not called Medieval Quest, is it?
It's not Medieval Quest, no. I don't think that one will hit the shelves anytime soon.
Okay, we never know. Now, look, I have to ask, and I don't want to dwell on it, but there's obviously been a little bit of controversy lately around Jacob Rosalski and some questions around, like, what is using sources as inspiration? What is copying? Now, I have to admit, I stay clear of Reddit mostly. But I did follow that discussion there. And firstly, I'd say hats off to you, sir, for the way you handled the discussion there. It can be a pretty rowdy place, let's say, to put it politely. is there any update on anything happening around that? It sort of seemed to have gone away, which I think is not a bad thing at all. What are your thoughts on that, just for our listeners?
Yeah, just in case your listeners aren't familiar with it, the idea is that someone did a lot of research, spent a lot of time looking into Jakob's art for Scythe in particular, and they found that he had referenced specific parts of specific photos and used them as references for his art. For example, there's an illustration, a really beautiful illustration, that has a mech in it, and it has a woman, and it has a soldier, and a bunch of stuff going on in the background, and it has a tiger in the foreground.
Yeah.
And there is a photograph, just a random photograph, I think, that Jakob found on Google Images that has a tiger in it, and he used that tiger as a model for his illustration.
Yeah.
Used the word copy. I would say that's a pretty accurate word, but it's not like he copied and pasted the tiger.
Yes.
But he did, if you look at it, like, all the stripes are in the exact same place as the photograph. It is that tiger for sure. And so a lot of the controversy is should Jakob have credited that artist, the photographer, things like that. But from my stance as a publisher, I licensed the art and the world of Scythe for a tabletop game in good faith that Jakob had respected any sources that he used. So Jakob and I have talked about it a bit, about how he used those photos and how he thinks he needs to reference them or get permissions in the future, or should he have gotten permissions. We've had a debate about that, and I think we have an understanding that we did license that in good faith, and in the future, I hope he's a little bit more open with me about that.
Yeah.
But I, like I said in the comment that you probably read in Reddit, I'm still amazed at his overall talent. I don't think he was out to hurt anyone, I think if he could do it over again, I think he would have changed a little bit, a few of the things about that tiger, and made it a little bit more unique to avoid this whole controversy.
And look, I guess it's a great lesson for everyone. You never know what people discover on the internet. A lot of people have a lot of time on their hands. And look, if there are people out there who always use 100% original thoughts, ideas, and images, then I'd be quite amazed. But I think what I really wanted to congratulate you on just was on the openness of the discussion. So I think, you know, it's great to see that happening out there, and you being 100% transparent. The fact you've actually engaged with Jakob about it is awesome. Is Rise of Fenris, is that the last expansion for Scythe?
It is. Yeah, we kind of went with an expansion trilogy that wasn't necessarily planned up front, but it ended up working out that way. And I do have a few accessories in the works. Like, there's we'll probably make some metal mechs. There's a modular board, but this is the thing that really the last thing that will really expand the game. And it's a big expansion. It's like we mentioned, it's an 8-game campaign.
Yeah.
There are 11 different modules in it. It's a pretty big box of stuff from punch boards that you unlock and discover. It's a big rule book, but you only have to read 2 pages for each episode that you play. And there's some pretty big tuck boxes that you'll open and be hopefully surprised by. Have you played Psy?
Yes, I have. I haven't played any of the expansions. I've played the base game, and I must admit, the at first glance at it, I was sort of thinking, it's another one of these mini fests. And right. I must admit, I was blown away by the fact that it was sort of way more Euro than minigame, but it is really, wouldn't say it's a perfect meld, but that meld between American-style game and a European-style game that we're seeing so much more of these days, it's very hard now to point to a game that is a pure Euro or pure American-style game. The styles are really bleeding across into each other, and I think that it was the first one of those that I had really seen. So I really enjoyed it. And this, the side of the Rise of Fenris, I was not aware of that, and until I started getting ready for this interview, and that fascinates me, I must admit, because narrative in a game is what I really look for, and that evolving story to me is really exciting.
Well, yeah, I'm glad to hear that. Like you said, I think Scythe is much more of an engine building game than a game with a bunch of combat, which can be a little misleading because it does have those big mechs fighting on the box. I'm excited to hear that you're drawn to narrative in games.
Yeah.
I think you'll enjoy what you see in Fenris.
Well, now, speaking of exciting, three words: My Little Scythe.
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of came out of nowhere last year when a designer and his daughter, or not, he wasn't a designer at the time. He was just a guy who knew of Scythe, played Scythe, enjoyed it, but wanted to play it with his daughter. And so they worked together to design a family-friendly version of Scythe. But it ended up being a lot more than that. Like, it's not just a distilled version of Scythe. It has very much its own heart, its own mechanisms, and I'm proud to be publishing it.
Yeah, so it's sort of, as you read about it, you can definitely see, inspired by Scythe, a lot of similarities by Scythe, but it's certainly not just a reskin, is it? And what's the industry response been to that?
I think the biggest response is that it's kind of made people smile, which I love to see. And maybe I think people smile for different reasons. Maybe they chuckle at it and they disregard it, or maybe they connect with it and say, I'm excited to play that with my kids, or I'm excited to play that with my game group. But, a 45-minute game where I get to have the spirit of Scythe in it, but instead of 90 to 2 hours. And that's the same reaction I had when I first played it. I was surprised and delighted by how much I enjoyed it when I played the prototype last summer.
Yeah, and it's so cute with those the cute minis, and the fact that they're the same animals from Scythe, but they're so cute. it might not be something that I would play with my game group, but I can see such a massive audience for it.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see how it does. I've seen a lot of excitement up front, but we'll truly know for sure in August when it hits stores.
Yeah, awesome. Now, look, I also wanted to say you've published an article recently just about how you like to support smaller reviewers, smaller content producers. Obviously, we're one of those, and we have really appreciated your support. You sent us a copy of Between Two Cities, which was absolutely awesome, and we loved it. So how have you found the industry has responded to you supporting smaller content producers like that?
You're referencing a blog article that I just wrote a couple days ago, and I was really surprised by the response. I think I posted it on... it was just a couple of days ago, and it blew up. There were so many people sharing it and talking about it, and I didn't see all the conversations. I don't really know, but I just know it got I was looking at the stats on my blog, and I was amazed by how many people were talking about it. And I think maybe they were connecting to that side that you're talking about now. While I do send stuff to the big reviewers, I want a lot of people to hear about our games.
Yeah, of course.
It's a marketing expense. I have found that. As great as it is for Tom Vassell to talk about a game and for 20,000 people to watch the video, it's also really powerful for a reviewer who has 20 loyal listeners to spend an hour talking about one of my games on their podcast or their video, or, you know, not even that much time. So I've tried to find ways to send games to a variety of reviewers and also let reviewers request what they want from me. And that way I kind of show reviewers, you know, I can't send you everything. I can't send every reviewer everything. But if you want to pick one or two things for me to send you, I'll make it happen. It is a little tougher to send it outside of the U.S.
Of course, yeah.
I've kind of sidled into a system where if a reviewer outside of the U.S. is willing to help me out with shipping and we can meet halfway there, then we can make that happen.
Yeah, look, I think that's a really great process, and we've certainly appreciated it, that's for sure. I did see that article shared multiple times in multiple Facebook groups. Because of that reason, and of course, the first thing I did was dive in to check the list to make sure we were in the list, and we were, so that's really great. I guess the last question is, what is next for you and Stonemaier Games? What have you got coming down the pipe? What can you tease for us?
Well, what can I tease? I won't give you any huge scoops, but I will say that we have one more brand new game coming out later this year that I'm really excited about. I got to play the pre-production copy of it just a few days ago, and I'm elated with how it turned out on every level.
Is this the cooperative one you mentioned a little bit earlier?
No, this is actually the next one. My Little Scythe, this game, then the next four new games we have coming out are designed by other designers. They aren't designed by me. I've been heavily involved in the development of the games, but I'm not the designer. I am personally working on 2 to 3 games right now, and I think one or two of them will be released in 2019 and maybe one or two in 2020.
Ooh.
But I have found my design time, because I have all these other great games that are being submitted to us, I take a little bit more time with my designs than I used to.
Yes.
I don't pressure to, you know, get one out every year. The Fenris took a lot of time this year, last year's design.
Okay, yeah. Well, look, I mean, given the success of what you've had, and, you know, I was just going to mention for our listeners who didn't know, as an example, Scythe. So you won an Italian Game of the Year award, a French Game of the Year award, a Swiss Game of the Year award, and you absolutely cleaned up on the Golden Geeks in 2016 with Scythe. Mm-hmm. You've had a huge success with Charterstone, and as I said, I'm excited to get that one to the table myself. Expansions continue to come out for Viticulture. One's just come out just the other day, I think, hasn't it? A new set of visitor cards?
That's right. Yeah, actually, it comes out tomorrow.
There you go.
Yeah.
So, I mean, look, one of the great things, I think, is you continue to support your games. And as a gamer who does, you know, fall in love with games, to have the game that you love continually supported just is breathing new life into it all the time, and you get to share it with new people. It's so exciting. So, look, just in wrapping up, Jamie, I do want to thank you for what you do in the hobby. The way you share everything you do, I think, is amazing. Your blog, being so generous with people like us and giving us the time today, I've really appreciated that. Look, I don't want to sound like too much of a fanboy, but I am. you know, you are one of the awesome presences in the hobby, that's for sure. And thank you so much for your time today. I've got one more thing I'd love to ask.
Yeah. And thank you for those kind words. That means a lot to me. And I aspire to do all those things that you say.
No. Look, I mean, I appreciate how you do take time out for the little people in the hobby like us, and you recorded a sting for our 200th episode. We really appreciate it. Is there any final messages you want to send our listeners before we go?
Well, I'll just kind of echo one of the things that we've talked about a little bit today, but that the keeping games alive, there's also different ways to do that. One is through expansions and promos and things like that, but another is just having conversations with people about games and getting older games back to the table. So for anyone who wants to join that conversation, I hope you do. I have Facebook groups for all of our games. You're welcome to join them, and I'm active in all those groups, so I'd love to hear your thoughts about our games. Or if you want to talk about, on my YouTube channel, I talk about a variety of it, a ton of other games. So if you ever want to talk about another game, just search for that game on my YouTube channel, and I bet I've talked about it. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Fantastic. Look, thank you so much for joining us today, Jamie, and hopefully we might catch up sometime in the future.
That sounds great. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Well, isn't that Jamie Stegmaier a lovely fellow? It was really great to chat with him. Anyway, we are off to BorderCon. Keep an eye on our social media stream so you can see everything we've been up to. And we'll be back next week with a normal episode to tell you all the things we've got up to. Anyway, in the meantime, you guys have a great time. Check out our social media. Check out our Patreon. Support us there. And thanks again for listening. Bye.
This has been another episode of The Dice Men Cometh, proudly sponsored by Area 52, offering comics, books, card games and board games for the whole family. Find them at 104 Elizabeth Street, Hobart, or online at area52.com.au. And find us online at thedicemencometh.com.